Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Drop and Go Parking. Offering easy and convenient parking, allowing you to hand over your keys and go directly to departures.
Welcome to Playback. The date is set, October 24th. And almost every day this week brought news of would-be presidential candidates bowing out and others stepping in. Now, by Friday afternoon, this would have changed. But on Tuesday...
Well, my goodness, I've got some breaking news. I'm joined on the line now by former Met aide and meteorologist Joanna Donnelly. Good afternoon to you. Is it true?
Oh, God, I'm absolutely... You know, I've never been nervous before in my whole entire life, and I'm absolutely shaking like a leaf right now. I have a feeling that the whole world is going to say the absolute audacity of this one.
And yet, she had seemed to be in...
So how does it develop from just people anecdotally asking you, will you run for the president, to now declaring that you want to be president of Ireland?
Oh, that sounds so ridiculous. It was when I was thinking, if I want to spend the rest of my life being a climate voice, a climate advocate for climate justice, and without alarmism and with compassion and trust and the relationship I've built with the Irish public for the last number of years is one where I have given of myself to the public so that they do trust when I say that I'm telling.
Okay. And without alarm, you want to discuss and put climate justice part of your platform.
Yeah.
So did you approach anyone so far? Have you been approached by anyone to run?
I have not been approached by
no party.
Anyone.
You've been approached by no party.
Absolutely not.
So what route will you take to become a candidate, do you think?
And the reason everybody knows about this now, and my face is actually gone completely red in having this conversation because, again, the audacity. But I sent in an email last night, and I said to myself, if I wasn't going to do it by the 1st of September, I wasn't going to do it. Mm-hmm. And just before midnight last night, I sent in emails to the chairs of the county councils. And
which councils?
Obviously, literally all of them. Because
the
I have
okay.
no... Yeah, because I have no... reason to believe that anybody would actually take this seriously. So I just threw the net wide and said, I'll see what happens. Look, the reason I'm doing it is because I want to be part of the voices going forward, and there isn't a better voice than the highest office in the country.
However, by Friday afternoon, Joanna Donnelly had made the decision to withdraw. Meanwhile, the interviews of confirmed candidates got started. On this week, a bit of a grilling for independent TD Catherine Connolly. Now, she has the backing of left-leaning parties and many in Labour, but not all. Former leader Alan Kelly has been critical of her. Justin McCarthy put this to Connolly.
One of the concerns he raised about you was your decision 7 years ago to give a presidential nomination to Gemma O'Doherty, who a month earlier had said that the HPV vaccine did not stand up to scrutiny. And now you told the Sunday Independent that you have no regrets about that decision. Why did you think it was a good judgment to nominate Gemma O'Doherty to run in the presidential race?
Well, first of all, that question has been framed in a way that, from Alan Kelly, in the way that I didn't support President Higgins. That's not accurate. I have the greatest of respect for Michael D. Higgins. Indeed, I think he's been extremely courageous. And I've said that publicly and privately on my interactions with him. That's number one. In relation to nominating someone, when the presidential election comes up, all TDs and senators are faced with the dilemma who to nominate. It's not the same as supporting someone. I did not and do not support Gemma O'Doherty. But I made a decision to be one of many nominees to give her a chance to stand. And it's something indeed that's come up again in this election. And so it deserves better, a more general discussion.
Did you know, though, when you gave her the nomination, that she had given an interview to the Business Post a month earlier in which she said that there was something seriously wrong with the HPV vaccine and that it did not stand up to scrutiny in her view?
To be honest, and I always strive to be as honest as I can, I can't remember at that. What I do remember, and what led me eventually, after thinking about it, was that this woman had done some good work. in relation to, as a journalist, in relation to investigations. That's what stood out for me at that time. And so I made that decision at that time. That it's really important to say that's not the same as endorsing somebody.
And also under scrutiny, a trip to Syria in 2018 alongside Maureen O'Sullivan, Claire Daly and Mick Wallace.
Did you raise any questions before you left for Syria about who you would be meeting and whether or not you would be meeting supporters of Bashar al-Assad like Mr. al-Shahabi? Did you ask about that possibility at all before you left?
We certainly knew who we were meeting, in the sense of we were going to the hospital, the nuns, we were meeting the Chamber of Commerce, and we were going to as many refugee camps as we possibly could.
And Mr. al-Shahabi is somebody who had publicly called for the death of a child who had criticised the Assad regime a year earlier. Did you know about his background? Did you know about his views and his remarks?
Again, at this point and looking back, I was certainly aware of certain matters. We were meeting him in the context of the Chamber of Commerce. Did I like this man? Was I impressed with this? Absolutely not.
I do want clarity because you said you were aware of certain matters before you had that meeting. Yeah. What were you aware of? Did you know about his remarks calling for the death of a child?
I'm sure I don't, to be honest, at this point, I couldn't. It's 6 years. All I can tell you is we went with a specific purpose of fact-finding on the ground. If I just could, please, because it's important, because actually, significantly, Deputy Maureen O'Sullivan's name is only being mentioned lately. And that's significant. She's always been left out of the narrative. We went on a fact-finding mission in relation to the Palestinian refugees over and over. And that's what we did.
But what did you know about Mr. al-Shahabi before you met him?
I know that it was an absolute brutal dictatorship in Syria, which I abhor and abhorred. Now, we have to remember that various members of Irish government, and particularly Micheál Martin, actually met with Assad. I've never done anything like that. I went for a specific purpose. I came back a different person in relation to destruction, in relation to dictatorships, in relation to how possibly can we use our voice.
Catherine Connolly speaking on Sundays This Week. And we still await the nomination for Fianna Fáil current frontrunners Jim Gavin and Billy Kelleher. But just to keep things fresh, on Monday, another name to add to the mix.
Bob Geldof.
Yes, a spokesperson for Taoiseach Micheál Martin confirming to me there in the last few minutes that Micheál Martin had a conversation with Bob Geldof on Friday. This initially reported by Sinan Maloney in the Irish Independent a short time ago, and he is saying that Bob Geldof is considering entering the race for the Oras, and he is flattered at speculation linking him to the presidency. A source close to Bob Geldof is quoted as saying he would find the presidency intellectually satisfying and could definitely do something with it. And he's mulling over his next moves in the days ahead.
Spoilt for choice. They should be making their decision next week. Phones binging and banging all weekend. Sinn Féin too, yet to nail their colours to the mast. But then, also Monday, clearing the way for Fine Gael to run just the one candidate.
MEP Sean Kelly has withdrawn from the contest to become the Fine Gael presidential candidate. In a statement issued this evening, he said it's clear he will not be able to gather the required nominations in the parliamentary party.
Leaving former minister Heather Humphreys their candidate of choice. And she too spoke to Justin McCarthy. But this time it was on Wednesday's News at One.
The current president, Michael D. Higgins, is somebody who has spoken up for the underprivileged in this case on many occasions. You're the Fine Gael candidate in this election, and you were a minister in the government which has overseen the worst homeless problem in the history of the state. As president then, how would you be able to speak up on social problems like homelessness when many people will say that you were in the government which caused that problem?
Yeah, well, first of all, I've been nominated by Fine Gael and I thank them for that. I won't be a Fine Gael president. I believe the presidency is above party politics, and I want to be a president for all the people on our island, and I will be a voice for people on this island. And yes, I have served in government. And did I get everything right? No, I didn't. But I always tried my best. And I look at Michael D. Higgins, and he was a former government minister. And I think that experience stood to him in the presidency. And he done our country proud over the last 14 years.
Are you proud, though, of your government's record on homelessness?
Yeah, well, can I just say that housing is the biggest challenge facing the country. And I know it's very tough. And I know people are putting off big decisions like starting a family because they don't have a home. They're putting their lives on hold. And I don't have all the answers on how to solve it. And there's billions being invested, but that's no comfort to people who see the prices going up. And, you know, there's a range of initiatives being taken now to try and speed up the planning process, unlock development and increase supply. We need to start seeing results from that. And of course, there were decisions maybe we could have made sooner. Maybe when I look back, we were cautious because we're after coming out of the recession. And there was a reluctance, from the Department of Finance to spend. And you can understand that.
So do you think mistakes were made then in the government of which you were a part in relation to housing?
Well, can I just put it this way? Did I get everything right? Did the government get everything right? No.
And there was more delving into decisions made and policies adopted.
You have been criticised by disability rights campaigners, most notably recently Senator Tom Clonan, over a green paper that you produced in 2023, which, according to Senator Clonan, would have made it compulsory to examine disabled Irish citizens for their ability to work. And if they could work, then they would have ended up receiving a lower disability payment. Do you regret bringing that proposal forward now?
Well, first of all, can I be very clear on this? I find this very hurtful because I have never tried to cause distress to anyone. And I've always advocated for disabled people and their rights throughout my career. The Green Paper was only ever a public consultation document. And anybody who reads it will see on page one that it is for consultation.
But it proposed a three-tier system where some people would have received lower benefits because they had a higher capacity to work.
No, nobody was going to receive lower benefits. But what I'm going to say is it was only ever a consultation. I had to start a conversation on how we might go about improving disability payments for people in this country. And during the consultation, I listened to people's views, including Senator Clonan. I met him directly and I spent a long time with him. And I heard his concerns. I heard the concerns of others. And based on those genuine concerns raised, I decided not to proceed with it. And I've always believed in consultation.
Heather Humphreys on Wednesday's News at One. And on Thursday, more announcements.
The former mixed martial arts fighter Conor McGregor has called on supporters to contact their local councillors to urge them to nominate him as a candidate in the presidential election. In a video message posted on social media, Mr. McGregor criticised the government for rising child homelessness and said people should contact their local authority representatives and ask them to put his name forward.
And then yesterday, Bertie out. Here's Gavin with Gary Murphy.
Said earlier on, Bertie bows out. Can you bow out of a race that you were never really in to begin with?
Probably not. I mean, it's a bit Schrodinger-esque in and out at the same time. But I never thought he was in because the Taoiseach and leader of Fianna Fáil since 2011, Micheál Martin, never wanted him.
And there we will leave our presidential roundup for now. But given the week of interviews, to quote the mighty Garth Brooks, unanswered prayers? Well, this question from Justin seems particularly apt.
Presidential campaigns are often robust, often quite bruising, and often people walk away from them with a lot of regret. Are you concerned about the next 6 weeks?
It is a bit tense, in fairness, and a while to go yet. Back in a bit. Welcome back. What a definite turn in the seasons, even chilly. But September is not only back to school time, those fresh copybooks. It can often masquerade as a stealthy January, a chance to begin again. And with the Darcy, Joe Humphreys. And they got in to the business end of success, failure and the illusion of a level playing field.
We now live in what's called a meritocracy. So, I mean, guess going back a few generations, people were less socially mobile. That is a big negative thing. You know, it was more hierarchical society. But you had some, you had something to blame. So if you didn't get on in life, you'd say, well, OK, that's, I didn't get the advantages of other people. I didn't, you know, I wasn't given a step up at the beginning. That's fine. And you've reasons why you don't succeed. Now, it's this idea, at least, that we're living in this meritocracy. Everyone's supposedly on a level playing field. Now, that's not the case. But
so they're promoted
the
or
message.
Whatever by merit.
That's the idea that everyone is. So, you know, and we all know that's not really true because people, some people start well behind on the starting line compared to other people get lots of advantages. But that's kind of the propaganda around this, the capitalist society we live in. And I guess that's a message that filters down through, you know, workplaces, through schools. If you don't get the job, you didn't deserve it. You know, some, you know, it's your fault. It's all on your head. You know, and it's a very different message. And again, even you think about a big rival message to that in cultures and societies, it comes from something like Christianity, which is its influence has failed, you know, or has faded. You have the core message of Christianity is no one is better than anyone else. We're all equal in God's eyes.
But mess up, fail and fall flat, we will. But now that's not enough. You've got to go and learn from your mistakes. There's no end to it.
There's like a trend, particularly about the super rich, that they talk about their failures as something that made them. Mm. So, you know, that sort of like Elon Musk talks about, you know, he's wealthy and rich because of his failures, and he kind of brags about having failed. Or Steve Jobs said, you know, famously was talking about his success. The best thing that happened to him was all these failures. And that, again, is a kind of a messaging that it's a self-serving one for them, because a lot of their failures they didn't have to clean up after. Society often cleans up after. But also for a lot of us, our failures, we don't actually learn from. And that should be said. So we do fail, we make mistakes. And there's nothing good necessarily that comes out of that. You just kind of make an embarrassing mistake or you don't learn from it.
Because I read it somewhere, you know, don't think about it as a mistake. Think about it as a learning
as an opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
I'm reading the books that you're talking about.
I'm against that message. Personally, right. I think you have to accept sometimes it's better. And I think it's a bit of a, I think it's a false message and it's not true. You know, that sort of messaging, it sort of makes people feel even more of a failure because they didn't, their failure didn't have a silver lining.
Oh, fail again, fail better, or maybe just fail, assuming you get the opportunity.
One of the things that comes up a little bit in the literature is failure deprivation. This idea that this is more blame the parents here, which is, you know, that we haven't had the opportunity to fail, to kind of learn from failing, kind of make mistakes in safe environments. COVID has been a factor, certainly for younger generations. Also, making failures, often it's more difficult now. People feel it's a much higher risk enterprise, particularly in the age of the smartphone. Failures are magnified and so on. So we have this failure deprivation, kind of the opportunity to fail.
Now, we wouldn't want to deprive you of that. So let's move on to breathing. You'd think you'd know how to do that at this stage in your life. But if you're mouth breathing, well, you're doing it all wrong. That is according to Patrick McKeown, founder of the Buteyko Clinic International and author of The Oxygen Advantage. He spoke to Anna Geary on Supercharged.
It's very common for people to mouth breathe. And when we think about the mouth, there's nothing inside the mouth that serves any purpose for breathing. Mm-hmm. Like the mouth only is for eating, for drinking, for speaking.
I think you might be forgetting kissing, but on you go.
So the nose has about 30 functions. And initially, when you switch to nasal breathing during physical exercise, there is an extra load, but that's where all the good stuff happens. So you're adding strength to the diaphragm. You're helping to reduce your sensation of breathlessness. You're improving blood flow, increasing oxygen delivery. You've got a faster recovery post physical exercise. And also, when we track heart rate variability and heart rate is lower for the same intensity. Now, granted, Anna, it does take a transition period. So at the start, the air hunger is a bit stronger, but then the body adapts to it.
The air hunger, you say, but nothing he believes the nose can't cope with.
Your nose is doing everything with regards to breathing. And even in terms of just oxygen transfer from the lungs to the blood, it was identified in 1988 that the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood increases by nearly 10% when you continuously nasal breathe. And then we have to consider, Anna, in this country, a lot of people are prone to exercise-induced bronchoconstriction, exercise-induced asthma. Mm-hmm. Your mouth doesn't warm the air. It doesn't moisten the air. It doesn't filter the air. It doesn't draw the air into the lower regions of the lungs. So breathing through the mouth is going to contribute to dry mouth, dry airways, mm-hmm. And for people who are prone to, say, exercise-induced asthma, can contribute to that. So we have to think about it. Our nose is what breathing is for. Yeah.
And he advised thinking of the whole thing like a series of gear changes.
If the air hunger gets too much, we're not saying going from nose-nose to mouth-mouth. We do say nose-nose. And then when the air hunger gets a bit too much, breathe in through your nose and out through your mouth, because that will get rid of the gas carbon dioxide, which will alleviate the air hunger. And then if the air hunger still isn't alleviated there, go to mouth-mouth. But then if you can transition back into nose-mouth and then nose-nose. So it's almost as if it's a system of gears that you're just transitioning from one to the other.
Gotcha. Nose-nose, mouth-nose. With Claire, neuroscientist Rachel Barr. And she is advising giving our brains a little bit of a break.
And do you think in general terms the message that we're getting from a lot of self-help literature and a lot of what we're seeing online is that you have to go into battle with your brain? You know, you have to discipline your brain. You have to wrangle your brain to do things that you want it to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so much of the advice that we're given in the wellness space is actually about extracting yet more labour, more productivity from drained bodies and mind. And there's this, all the language around brain stuff, it tends to be hack your brain as if it's, you know, a machine. You can hack into submission, but of course it's not. That's not how the brain functions. And part of the reason I've called the book How to Make Your Brain Your Best Friend, and I mean, throughout the book, I kind of anthropomorphise the brain, describe it like a little pet that you're charged with caring for, is because I think that changes how people approach self-care. You know, this idea of like hacking your brain to submission, the absurdity of that, I think, becomes clear the instant you apply that to any other living thing. So if your dog or your child is acting out, you don't go online looking for advice about how to hack them into submission. You know, you try to understand their distress, hopefully, and provide care and kindness.
So yes, it's incredibly busy, but also we're spending way too much time on our own.
Our brains have been shaped through social evolution. It's one of the major factors that went into shaping our human brains. To be exiled from the group meant you were toast. You simply wouldn't survive without the help and the protection of your family and your tribe. So even now in the modern age, the brain interprets loneliness as kind of an ongoing threat environment. And so you stay in kind of a perpetual state of chronic stress. You've got like chronic stress hormones pumping through your body. You go into a pro-inflammatory state because your body thinks you're likely to be injured any moment now because you're not with your tribe. And of course, that then has knock-on effects for cardiovascular health and all-cause mortality, just like smoking and obesity.
And Rachel, if you become more and more isolated, then it's harder to break out of that, isn't it?
Unfortunately, our brains adapt to long stretches of loneliness, not by upgrading our skills to find connection, but actually by eroding them. So there are a bunch of different adaptations that happen in the brain that then make it yet more difficult for us to connect with other people and sometimes can dampen our desire to even try. Simply holding that awareness, you know, if you think everybody hates you and, oh, it looks like everybody doesn't like me and you're interpreting social signals as hostile all the time, telling yourself this might be self-preservation mode, just trying to give yourself and the people around you a little bit of benefit of the doubt, I think that can meaningfully reduce its power over you.
Neuroscientist Rachel Barr with Claire. And continuing on our quest for total enlightenment, oh yeah, with Brendan at the weekend, Dr. Tony Bates. And he spoke about our shadow self, our secrets, our shame and our vulnerability and why we need to talk about it.
We need to disclose. We talk about, oh, it's very important to talk to someone if you're troubled. But I don't think we often ask, oh, why is that important? And what the hell does that, it's going to make any difference. Life is still life. Well, I think what happens is first I hear myself when I speak. I begin to acknowledge this is a difficulty for me. And I may not like that. I may hate it. I may be embarrassed and disappointed in that. But suddenly I'm hearing myself say it. It's real. And I'm beginning to take responsibility. And the other thing is that when it's said, it loses a lot of its voltage, a lot of its power. And it becomes, from being something shameful that's stuck in my body, it becomes something workable that I can begin to
take care of and nurture in some way.
And if you don't have that someone to talk to, will writing it down?
I think writing is very, very close. Yeah. Writing confession and just even just doing yourself a voice memo.
Wow. Something, yeah. And do you listen to it afterwards?
I think you can, and maybe if you're very lucky, somebody else might listen, and who could actually really hear you and, you know, be compassionate.
But the act of doing it?
I think the act of doing it itself is very releasing and very revealing.
And he talked about the power that comes from admitting our vulnerabilities.
I mean, that was Jung's main contribution was, look, he said the hardest thing in the world is to accept yourself, and it's the most difficult journey we all make, and we make it slowly and hauntingly, and it's over years, but the end point of it is that we're more unified and we're more visible and we're more real. One of the questions for me around all of this is, well, how can I be with my vulnerability? How can I be with this stuff? Because secrets are often a disguise for my vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, where we really project the most positive image of ourselves is where we are probably most vulnerable, actually. And so, yeah.
That's a good thing to remember about other people as well, isn't it? Because,
yeah,
you know, you think everybody else is
they think they're fine,
super
but
confident
actually,
and all that, but yeah.
No, I think they're not fine. But I do think that the being with vulnerability is, I think, one of the secrets of mental health, and maybe the most fundamental task. It's not actually feeling good, it's about actually how to handle feeling bad.
Now you might be thinking, all very well to say we need to embrace, nay expose our soft underbellies, but just how would you start?
It kind of starts with, you know, I don't really understand tracker mortgages. It's that kind of start, you know, just admitting that you don't have everything sorted. You don't have an opinion on every single world issue at the moment. Some of them, in fact, you find so complex and so bewildering, you don't know what to say. So it's about being willing to say who I'm not and what I'm not and what I don't know, rather than to project, I have it sorted. And that's the very basic kind of description of vulnerability. And that's you can do in the pub. And then in more intimate relationship, it's about talking with someone, not about you make me feel. I think the most important thing in vulnerability is that you talk in the first person. It's, I feel a bit bothered by something I'd like to talk about, or I feel upset when this kind of thing happens. I don't know why, but I'd love to kind of get my head around it. And that's why when you said something, it sort of really was hard for me. I was just in a very vulnerable place. So that's the kind of conversation between friends.
And it even feels when you say it like you're opening up to the world instead of like holding it all together.
Yeah. You have a chance to move through it and let it go.
In fact, he'd go so far as to say our vulnerabilities might just be the key to everything.
Vulnerability is our superpower. It is our greatest strength because it's what allows us to connect with ourselves and with each other in a compassionate way. And nothing is more powerful than that, because that's where resilience comes from. That's where real clarity and purpose and energy and empowerment come from, those connections.
Dr. Tony Bates with Brendan, thus ending our September Start Over section. Sure, we're positively levitating. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Patriotism, racism and flags. Last weekend, activists organised a rally to stand up against crime and anti-social behaviour in Fairview Park in the north of Dublin City. Joe Mooney phoned into Column on Liveline and he talked about their decision to fly the Irish tricolour at the rally.
Were there any kind of banners or flags or anything that would have identified what the group was about for anybody passing by?
No, we were very clear at the residents' request that we asked that there be no party political displays. And though a number of political figures turned up, councillors and TDs, they were there just to take part, not to highlight themselves. There was no banners to display. But very importantly, the Irish tricolour was flown throughout the event. And that was really important. And it was explained at the beginning of the rally or at the beginning of the vigil and at the end of the vigil why it was flown. And what was said very clearly is the Irish tricolour was flown proudly throughout this event. Its importance as a symbol of unity, anti-sectarianism and overcoming division was stressed throughout. And That's really important because we see around the city and not too far from Fairview Park, we see people flying the tricolour and they're using it to send out a very nasty message. They're using it to express some kind of superiority, to express racism and hate towards the migrant community. And that's not what the tricolour is about. These people do not understand the history of the tricolour, what it stands for. So it was important for us there, as we're sending out an anti-racist message and the message of togetherness for our communities, to have that flag to negate what other people are trying to do with it.
And the tricolour is an increasing feature of many streets and areas in Dublin City, but not always with the message of a Cead Míle Fáilte.
I mean, do you feel that the current discussion about taking down flags when they're hung out in particular areas runs the risk of people who portray the flag or use it in a particular way would almost, that ownership of the flag would be nearly ceded to them if the flag in and of itself is seen as a negative when it's hung up?
Absolutely. And that's why we made sure that the flag was there as a positive. And we would love people to see it as a positive symbol. In regards to the people who put up the flag, we can see what's happened across the water. In England, the same thing has happened with the Union Jack, and same thing has happened with George's Cross. These are being put out there to send out a message of hate and intimidation. But there's also a trap in it as well, because these people are trying to get a reaction. And that's what's happening with the tricolour. These people are putting it up as a symbol of hate, as a symbol of intimidation. And they want controversy. They want them taken down so they can run around saying, oh, they hate the Irish, they're just anti-Irish, we're the real Irish. My opinion, if the flags break the bylaws, they have to come down. But what I would like to see is maybe an effort taken to explain the story, the history and the symbolism of the tricolour. Maybe on the poles where there's tricolours put up, if they're there as a symbol of hate. Right. Maybe put up a corrugated poster underneath it that explains the true history and the true meaning of it.
And maybe included in that would be worth pointing out that the flag actually did come back from France. It was as a kind of a revolutionary symbol. It was drawn up in the likeness of the Republican tricolour in France.
Yes, in many ways, while it is the Irish tricolour, in some ways it is a foreign flag. It was a gift from a foreign nation. And the people who are using the flag as a symbol of hate at the moment, they don't get it. They never do anything positive for their community. They have nothing positive to say. And now they're even using the flag as a negative. And we have to reject that, and we have to make sure that's not what becomes the story of our flag.
From Liveline. And it was patriotism at a whole other level in China this week. A parade of laser weapons, nuclear ballistic missiles, giant underwater drones and robotic wolves. All ostensibly to mark 80 years since the country's victory over Japan in World War II. 26 heads of state attended alongside Xi Jinping, including Russia's Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Claire Brock on Drive Time spoke to Finbar Birmingham Europe correspondent with the South China Morning Post.
It's really an effort from China to show that this is, China has close friends, that these so-called international pariahs are welcome in China, and that there is an alternative to the Western order that has dominated since World War II. You know, at a time when America is in sort of disarray, when people are losing confidence in the rules-based order of the West, China is looking to present an alternative. You know, as Callas said today, this is they're seeking to fast track a new world order, and the messaging was very potent.
Oh, it certainly was that. And many in the West condemned the show of camaraderie and force, not least the Donald, who accused the three leaders of conspiring against the US of A. But how seriously should we take all of this?
Can we put much weight on it? We have the European Commission Vice President coming out really strongly about this autocratic alliance seeking, as you say, a new world order. I mean, is that a real fear, and is that a realistic fear?
I think there's a fear that China is trying to create something different. And, you know, some of the less remarked upon events of the last few days is the rollout of something called the Global Governance Initiative and China's way of doing governance. And, you know, we see this over the last few years, China being very successful in Africa, training diplomats and training political parties and so on. So behind all of this pageantry, there is a determined effort from the Chinese to change things almost from the inside, whereas Russia really wants to destroy everything and raise everything to the ground. China is very content to change the system from the inside. So when when Trump is burning multilateral organizations like the WTO and the UN, China is very happy to stick in there and try and change it from the inside. So I think the subtleties are probably a little bit more concerning for the Europeans than even the big grandstanding military parades.
All right. Well, we know that Vladimir Putin has responded to Trump's comments saying the US president does not lack a sense of humour. There we'll leave it.
From Drive Time, and that theory might have been tested if he'd tuned in to Oliver yesterday.
Rumours of his demise were greatly exaggerated. Donald J. Trump, this J stands for jingoism, we know now, he announced after his 7-day absence from public view, kind of like a panda is taken away from a zoo to give birth. He just disappeared for 7 days and he's back. Well, he announced that he's still alive, and there was, of course, audible delight at the news. And I like to think of his explanation kind of going, a lot of people said that I had died, which is fake news. There's never been a president more alive than I've been, the most ever. Been to the bathroom like 14 times in the last 12 hours. Nobody's seen numbers like this. Biden can go to the potty. In fact, I know he probably died in office. A lot of people say that he died. I saw the corpse. And even as a corpse, he was still busy destroying our country. Where was I? Donald J. Trump, not dead. But I tell you, if I did die, I'd probably be, I just keep on working, keep working. Bury me under the ballroom that I'm going to build with, like, the crypto money. No one does crypto like I do. And embalm me in an oil, American oil, the KFC oil. I'll still be here, along with the cockroaches. No offense, JD. You can get some of the oil, sponge it off the walls of my bathroom. It's a beautiful bathroom and bedroom, too. Also, if I died, it'd be the most incredible death. They'd say, wow. They'd say, he looked so good at dying. The greatest ever. Better than Lincoln. He was a loser. He got shot watching theater. Who goes to the theater? Maybe women do. I don't know. I don't go to the theater. It's full of woke people crying about slavery as if it was a bad thing. Whoa, no, I'm going to die at a wrestling pro final sponsored by slavery. That's the way I'm going to go. Wow, Donald died the American way. Shot by a machine gun made out of hamburgers. That's the way to go. Thank you for your attention to this matter. Here's some music. It better be good music. Hope it's not Mexican music or music from China. I can do music. I do the best music. You wouldn't believe. I'm one of the most incredible people.
On Arena with Kira King in the chair, award-winning playwright Simon Stevens. He's written the adaptation Vanya and also this theatrical behemoth.
People may know you through the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, and that became a global phenomenon. And looking back, how do you feel about its success now?
Oh, that's a lovely question. Look, on one hand, it was entirely life-changing. The kind of plays that I normally write are normally kind of quite weird or strange or dark. I collaborated over the last couple of years with a theatre in Dublin called Glass Mask that have kind of like a 30 seats in this wine bar off Grafton Street. And that's like my happy place, making work with kind of quite bold, difficult artists. And Curious was a show that was seen by 5 million people. So that's unlike anything I've ever experienced before. Well, I'm proud of it. I'm very proud that for a great many people who don't ordinarily go to the theatre, it was the first time they'd ever seen any theatre. And it was unapologetically theatrical, you know? It wasn't like watching a film on stage. It wasn't a vehicle for a star actor. And I've done one or two of those in my time. But it was just purely, unapologetically, a theatrical exploration of what theatre can be.
And what is that like, winning the Tony and the Olivier Award? Is it like... You know, I hear actors talking about what it's like when they win an Oscar, but like, it has to be kind of amazing too.
It's just weird. It's just weird. They're both very, very weird occasions. As I said to you, I think I'd probably rather just kind of like have a bottle of wine with some kids on Grafton Street than kind of swan around places like that. But on the other hand, I met Jason Alexander, who played George Costanza in Seinfeld. So that was exciting. And I've got the gongs in my house, you know, so it's not like I'm ashamed of them. It's not why I do it, you know.
I do it
to move people. And I do it for the possibility that we can communicate with one another. And now more than ever, it feels like an essential and an important thing to be doing.
Now, Stevens is coming to Cork for Sounds from a Safe Harbour, thanks to the hard sell from Enda Walsh.
He said, rarely is there such a combination of boldness in terms of artistic exploration and inventiveness, and the fact that just people who just like regular folk will just be watching everything and they'll be completely fearless in telling you what they think about what you're doing. And anything Enda says, you know, is good enough for me. I trust him.
That is fair enough. Enda's great. And I'll actually agree with you about Cork City as well. And Cork in general, you know, it's great fun.
It's going to be my first time. I can't wait.
Well, you're in for a treat. You are in for a treat. But don't tell Cork people that I said that, OK?
We hear you, but doubt they need the affirmation. Now, Stevens is bringing a piece called Your Voice to the festival. And at its core, it's an exploration of desire and features drum and bass and a voiceover from Jesse Buckley.
We follow this woman from the moment before her birth. So it starts when she's in the womb. And it culminates in the moments before her death. And in the course of an hour, you go through the span of her life, structured around the seven ages of man that Jacques describes in Shakespeare's As You Like It. I wrote text which, in some sense, I thought could be danced to. And then we're going to spend a week in this deranged-sounding festival, which I think, the more I think about this, I have to say, In London, I don't know what it's like in Ireland at the moment, but in London, theatre is so frightened. The pandemic has been such a paralysing kind of phenomenon. And in its fear, theatre has become more and more conservative. Shows are built around star casting. They're built around celebrity actors. They're built around known stories or known IPs, you know, adaptations of films or books. And there's Cork City, Mary Hickson and Enda Walsh and all of those guys, Killian and Max, are creating a space where artists can gather and just play and explore and make things up and go back to that child space where all of us started. You know, we all started kind of as kids asking that question, what if? And it's rare, those spaces now. They're really rare. I can't wait.
Oh, that does sound kind of deadly, in fairness. Simon Stevens on Arena. With the Darcy, bit of messing.
I'm not going to land her in. So,
right.
So
strange rooms in people's houses.
Right? Yeah. She said that they don't know why, because she's passed away now. She wouldn't allow flans into the house, right? Which I thought was the most niche rule in the world. And I was going, what? So like flans, you remember those flans you'd buy, right? Yeah. And I said, that can't be true. She says, no, she had some really weird thing. She would, no flans. And I said, and then she said that when her older sister had a child, right? And it was her son's birthday, right? Yeah. Is this real? Is this happening, right?
So, are we on air?
So when she said, when the son, her first, it was like a baby boy or whatever, she had to ring her and ask permission, would it be all right to bring in a sponge cake?
And I was there's a difference between a flan and a sponge cake.
Ray Darcy, yeah. That's what I said at the time. I said, no, there is a difference between a flan and a... And we were kind of asking her, is it all like egg-based things? That was not, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
No, on this one is a big one in our house, no room-to-room shouting.
Right, oh, so yes,
if my wife is in a room.
I like that one. I like that one.
Because this is what I hear. And I'm going, I can't hear you. And what she hears is, so she hears, yes, I will collect the child at 4:30. And then it's 4:30. You said you could. No, no. Because what I heard was, right? So no room to room shouting.
I say it all the time. I can't hear you. There's walls in me.
I'm telling you,
why do people do that?
Because they ain't no good, man. They ain't no good. Bringing us to the traitors. Oh, the treachery of which people are capable. It would undermine your faith in humanity if it weren't so compulsive to watch. Not least for Siobhan McSweeney. That eyebrow flanked by the hounds. Never mind the rig out, the tweed and taffeta.
Your version of the traitors, the Irishness is lovely. What unique traits do you think this one... some of them were evident very early on. It's very different to every other version of the traitors we've seen.
What do you think, Oliver? Like, I'm interested in that because I sort of feel it's sort of a dangerous road to go down of the whole sort of exceptionalism kind of thing, you know, that every country has a unique thing. But I do think just the look of it, I know that, like, it was one of the people involved in the franchise of the show was quite amused over how quickly everybody started chatting to each other when the contestants came in.
Yeah.
That usually takes a while for people in other countries to warm up and whatever, but not in Slane. They were chatting away to each other and accusing each other before they had even sat down for the first cup of tea.
I just love the sarcasm. Just, you know, are you a traitor? All day long. That's me, all day long.
Yeah. I love the phrase, I am, yeah.
I am, yeah. It's so disarming, and that doesn't exist in the other versions.
Yeah.
It's a cuteness, isn't it? It's cuteness.
Oh my God, there's a lot of cuteness there, you know? Yeah. I'm always surprised when people say that Ireland's such a friendly place, and you're like, we're smiling. I wouldn't turn my back on anyone.
You've been working as an actor a long time. I mean, you're in a great moment in your career, aren't you?
Oh, sure, it's downhill from here now. I think if we are going to go into the Irish exceptionalism, we're great begrudgers. So I'm just waiting for the entire nation to turn on me. And you know what? I wouldn't blame you.
Siobhan McSweeney with Oliver. Now, there is a woman for the big house. Go on. And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.